There we go. Okay. And we are spotlighting for everybody. But that's okay. You can always turn back to gallery view if you want to see everybody. And we are sharing screen. Okay. We're good?
Yeah.
All right. The other thing I'm going to do is just temporarily put everybody on a quick mute just to take out background noise, and feel free to unmute at will. Okay. So last week, I think we're trying to focus primarily on this phrase, David Yoshev B'Yerushalayim, and on the significance of the moment, the context that leads to the story of David and Bathsheba. The fact that there's a significant war going on that is taking place, and Yoav is leading that campaign against Ammon, and that campaign against Ammon plays in a significant part of the background. That's where Uri is coming from, that's where Uri is going back to, that's where David has Uri killed. So clearly that war is playing a role in the story, still going on. And David Yoshev B'Yerushalayim, and the significance of David not participating in that battle. So last week we talked about it from the perspective of the sense that the wars on the eastern side of the Yarden are wars that David has kind of lost the stomach for, that David has lost his belief in, that these are wars of expansion, wars of conquest, wars of that established the empire of David's territory. And he found himself in these wars, not by choice, but by default. The story with Ammon starts with he sends a peace delegation to the king of Ammon, and those soldiers are shamed publicly, and David has to respond. And from there, we end up in the Battle of Aram. And from the Battle of Aram, David has to take retribution against the armies of Edom and Moab that gave safe passage to Aram. So it's a series of events that took place kind of one after the other, all on this side of the Yarden. And David, very different from the battles that David fought in the early part of his kingdom, which were all here in Eretz Plishtim and in the south in Yehuda, and kind of wars that were for the defense of the of the community of Israel, the people of Israel. The wars that started in chapter 8 and 10, kind of one story, all start on this side of the Yarden. They start outside the purple, which is the original territory of Israel during the days of Shaul. They start in Ammon, they end up with Aram, they end up in Edom, Moab, and Aram again, and Ammon again. And they also carry a different tenor morally. There's a different way in which these battles are fought and have to be so, but nonetheless, David has kind of lost the energy for them. And so he sends Yoav. He sends Yoav the first time, sends Yoav the second time, David Yoshev B'Yerushalayim. So we spend some time talking about it from the perspective of the erosion of David's commitment and of the moral fiber of what David sees as the erosion of the moral character of the army of Israel, the people of Israel, even himself. He doesn't like what he's seeing. He wants to get out of this battle as quickly as possible. That's one side of this equation. Unfortunately, there's another side of this equation. And I think we would be remiss if we didn't identify it. It's a little bit more of a critique directed at David, but nonetheless, I think that it is necessary to recognize. And that the fact is that David sends Yoav to fight this battle against Ammon, and he does so twice. And I think that that's important to notice. The first time they engage Ammon is in chapter 11, the previous parak, after the soldiers are shamed and Ammon gathers the forces, his backup, if you will, from all of the forces of Aram, by Reuben, Ammon, Kini, Vashubi, David. When Ammon saw that they were become despised by David. They went and they hired the armies of Aram, Aleppo and Damascus, and all of the major forces of the north. In the meantime, Vayishlach et Yoav, Vayishma David, Vayishlach et Yoav et kol hatzava ha-giborim. David sent Yoav and the army of the mighty men, the warriors, the smaller group, and he sent them to fight against Ammon. And it's unclear what David's intention here was. I think he, in a certain sense, underestimates the force of Ammon. And of course, that we know that Ammon has a backup. If you remember that campaign, the armies of Aram came around from the south down here to Medva, and Yoav found himself surrounded north and south in two fronts, which is what he references. Sorry, that's not what I wanted. And so Vayar Yoav Kieta Elav Pnei Melchama Mipanim Umeachor. When Yoav saw the battle was set against him on two fronts, before him, in front of him, and behind him, then he has to divide the army. He divides it with Avishai, and we went through this story several times. But it's a moment where he's threatened with the possibility of actually losing. There's a real potential danger to lose this campaign, to lose the war. And so he has to encourage his brother, Chazak v'nit Chazak, be'adameinu, be'adamei Elokeinu, be strong, be courageous, fight for our cities, fight for the cities of God. This is a major moment. And then we find the beginning of chapter 11, Vayilu tshuvat ha-shana, v'yishlach David et Yoav et avadav imo. So a year later, after all of the wars, after the war in the north, and after the war with Edom, and after the war with Moab, ostensibly, and now war with Ammon. So a year later, after all these campaigns, as we said, David is tired, David is frustrated, but at the same time, he also sends Yoav to this campaign on his own. And so what I would like to do, with your permission, is take a step back. And if we're looking at two wars in which David sent Yoav and stayed behind himself, or it's two halves of the same battle, if you will, I want to compare this story to a different war of a different era, also which was built out of or made up of two campaigns to the same battle, and which seemed to suffer from the same Achilles heel as the story of Ammon. And what I am referring to is the story of the Battle of Ai. So we mentioned it briefly last week in a different context. We would explore it in more detail. I want to spend this most of the remaining shiur today. I want to look at the story of Ai in more detail. So we're going to turn our attention to Yoshua Perek Zayin. Context for a moment is important. So I'm going to pull up an old map that you may or may not remember. This is the map of the conquest of Yoshua and the era of the Shoftim. And so if I look at it, this is, Yoshua and the army cross the Yarden here near Yericho. They set up camp in the city of Gilgal, or an area called Gilgal. And Yericho is the first major war that they fight. It's not really a war. They have a walled city, the army inside. And again, Yeshua, challenged by the walls of the Israel, he needs to figure out a way to either get the army out from the wall, behind the walls, or compensate for the wall itself. In the case of Yericho, famous story, surround the city seven hakafos with shofar and with the aron and with the God's presence. And on the seventh day, they blow the trumpets and God causes a miracle and the walls crumble beneath themselves, and then they can go in and conquer the city. So Yericho is a major victory who was designed to send tremors, physically and figuratively, to send tremors through the entire land so that the Canaanites understand that we have moved into this territory. All right, so let's look at Yehoshua Perek Zayin. At the end of Perek Vav, the end of the Battle of Yericho, Yehoshua had made everybody take an oath as they began to conquer. V'tipol ha'chomat tachteh, as the wall came and fell. V'yal ha'am ha'ira ish nekdo, the city that had surrounded the city, and they just attacked the city. V'yachrimu et kol asher ba'ir, they destroyed all that was in the city. And they, Yeshua made a, took a, an oath. They defined the city as much along the lines of an ira nidachat, of an idolatrous city, and they made an oath that they weren't going to take any of the spoils. They made a special oath. Nobody's allowed to rebuild the city of Yericho, and nobody can take of the spoils of war. To take of the spoils of war is the first city. It was Mukdash. It was sanctified. It was defined as Kodesh LaHashem, and no spoils were allowed. And that's where the context of Perek Zayin begins. Vayima'alu b'nei Yisrael ma'al b'cherem. Israel trespassed, committed a trespass, a violation. Me'ila is considered, is translated as trespass. It's a violation where you use that which is sanctified for the mikdash, or sanctified to God. You take it for personal property, personal benefit. It's called me'ila. Vayima'alu b'nei Yisrael ma'al b'cherem. Israel trespassed against this cherem. Vayikach Achan ben Karmi ben Zabdi ben Zerach Tamatei Yudah min Echerem Yichaaf Hashem b'bnei Yisrael. He violated, he took the Cherem, and God was angry at Israel. Background, next story. Vayishlach Yehoshua Anashim Yericho Ha'ai. Yeshua then sent people, spies, from Yericho to the city of Ai, Asher in Beit Aven, Miketem LeBeit El, it's a city just east of Betel, and he says to them, "Alu v'raglu et ha'aretz, go spy out the city of Ai, v'alu ha'anashim v'yeraglu et Ai." So they go and they spy out to see what the city of Ai is all about. To put in perspective, here is the city of Yericho, and they're heading up to Shechem. That's their target, but they have to go through the city of Ai near Beit El. Yoshua, come back to Yoshua, and they said, don't take the whole nation. That's just ridiculous. Take all the 600,000 soldiers, the entire army of Israel, to take them up to one city. You only need 2,000, 3,000 soldiers. 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers is all you need to knock out Ai. Ai is an easy picking. Don't make the people toil and make them weary. Don't take them all there. There are a few people. It's a small city. Maybe it's 10,000, 12,000. You don't need them. So they send 3,000 people. And the result was that they attacked the walled city of Ai, and they turned and fled. And the people of Ai were victorious. 36 men died at that initial campaign, possibly more. And the people of Ai chased Israel from the gate unto Shvarim. And smote them as they were descending the hill. So probably more than the initial 36, maybe many more died in that second wave. End result, Israel's hearts were melted, became like water. Vayikra Yeshua Simlota, Vayipola Panav Arza, Yeshua tore his garments and he fell on his face, Lifnei Avon Hashem Ad Ha'arev, before the ark. Hu Vizikne Yisrael, Vayalu Afar Rosham, they put dust on their heads, ashes. Vayomer Yeshua, Aha Hashem Elokim. It's really an extraordinary tefillah of Yeshua. He cries out to God, he says, God, Lama Evarta Avirata Amazeta Yarden. Why did you bring us over the Yarden? To hand us over to the Amorites, to cause us to perish? We would have been better off if we had stayed on the other side of the Yarden. What am I going to say now that Israel has turned their backs against their enemies and fled? When the Canaanites hear that we were defeated, they'll come against us, they'll destroy us, they'll cut off our name. What are you going to do to your great name then? Vayomer Hashem al Yeshua, Kum lach, Yeshua, get up. Why are you on your face? You want to know why Israel was defeated on the battlefield? Israel sinned, they transgressed my covenant. They took of the forbidden, devoted things, sanctified spoils of war of Yericho, v'gam ganvu, and they stole, v'gam kichashu, and they lied about it, v'gam samu b'chlehem, and they hid it, and they put it into their backpacks. They stole, and they covered it up. You want to deal with the problem of Ai? Go deal with the root cause, as they say, of the chait of Israel. They will not be able to stand against their enemies. They will turn their backs to their enemies as they flee because they took of the cherim. They will be destroyed. I will no longer be with them unless you remove the cherim from your midst. So kum kadesh adam amartat. Okay, so here's the plan. And he gives him a whole plan about how to identify who the guilty party is. It's interesting that God doesn't tell Yeshua who the guilty party is. He just says, here's the lots and draw the lots and by tribe and then by family. And by the time it's all done, you'll know who it is. And that's exactly what Yeshua does. V'yashkem Yeshua baboker v'yakrev Yisrael lishvatav v'yilached shevet Yehuda. The tribe of Judah was identified by the lots, and then the family of Zerach, and then the family of on and on till Ayilached Achan ben Karmi ben Zabdi ben Zerach l'mantei Yehuda until Achan was found. Achan admits to his guilt. He saw some gold and silver there, and he took it. He provides it. They destroy it, and he himself was put to death for having committed the crime of trespass against the sanctified cherem of Yericho. And at the end of that story, they bury him, they put a great heap of stones upon him, they call the name of the place Emek Achor, the valley of shame. That's a very famous phrase because that was the first defeat as we entered into Israel. And the Navi, one of the Naviim, talks about, Micha, I think, talks about the redemption in the future when the valley of tears and the valley of shame will be transformed into the valley of hope. And the phrase is, V'ya emek achor lefetach tikva. And it's the source of the name of the city, the modern city of Petach Tikva is named after that phrase. So that's just a side point FYI. All right. So let's talk a bit gadol. Let's talk about what happened here. Yeshua sends the people of, sends spies to the city of Ai. They come back and they say, this one is an easy, easy pick. Don't bother with the whole army. But Yeshua doesn't understand that he has an Achilles heel in his camp, namely Achan, who's violated the cherem of Yericho. And so they send these 3,000 soldiers who get decimated and defeated, and the people of Israel are distraught, and Yeshua is distraught, doesn't know what to do, and he cries to God, and God says to him, you have a problem. Identify the problem, fix the problem, and then you can move on. Do they identify the problem? Yes. Do they fix the problem? Yes. Okay. So they've identified the problem and they fix the problem. At that point, they now they have to go back to Ai. Now, I was going to read Perek Chet first, but before I get to Perek Chet, which is the second battle of Ai, this is the first battle of Ai. Now we're going to get to the second battle of Ai. But before we do, assuming that the problem, as the text begins, Perek Zayin begins, Vayimalu b'nei Yisrael ma'al v'cherem, the source of the problem begins with the trespass against the cherem of Yericho violated by Achan. When God chastises Yeshua, his words reflect Chatai Yisrael, v'gam avru et briti, eshet ziviti, v'gam lakum min hacherem, v'gam ganvu, v'gam kichashu, v'gam samu b'chlehem. Everything God says to Yeshua seems to revolve around around Achan and the cherem of Yericho. Assuming we have identified the source of the problem, we have removed the source of the problem, what should happen now?
He should win the battle.
He should win the battle, right? He should go back to Ai and this time win the battle. Now, anybody who's ever done a science, a comparative study in science knows that when you want to identify the source of a phenomenon, you run two experiments. How many variables do you choose? Do you change between the first experiment and the second experiment?
Just one.
Just one.
You have to know what the variable is.
Correct. Because if you change two variables, you never know which was the real source of the problem. Right? So by that argument, if the source of the issue is Achan, when you go back to I, step two, how should the battle unfold? What should Yeshua's battle plan, strategic battle plan, be, assuming that the problem has been identified, namely Achan and the Cherem of Yericho, and has been eradicated? Achan is dead, Cherem has been destroyed.
They should win the battle.
They should win the battle, but what should be the battle plan? Judy, you're in mute, or your sound is off.
Same as the first one.
Same as the first one. All right, Judy, raise your thumb if you agreed. Same as the first, right? In other words, they should go back to Ai with exactly the same number of soldiers and exactly the same battle plan, and this time be victorious, because clearly the problem was Achan. Strangely enough, when we read Perek Chet, Vayomer Hashem el Yoshua, God gives Yoshua the battle plan. Step two, Al tiravi al techat, don't be afraid of I, don't be dismayed. Kachimcha et kol am emilchama, go and take all the people of the army. Vakum aleha I, and go and attack I. I will give you the king in this land to your hand. You will do to I what you did to Yericho. And on this time, you will be allowed to take the cherem. And here's the battle plan. First, you're going to lay ambush for the city behind it. Yoshua sends 30,000 into an ambush behind the city. They're not even the attacking force. They're the ambush behind the city. And he tells them, you're going to lay an ambush behind the city. Don't go very far. And I will take all the rest of the people, and we will attack the city. But when the people of Ai, the army, will come out against us, and we will turn and flee, v'nasdu lifnehem, we will turn and run. And they will think that they have us running second time. V'yotzu acharenu, they'll come running after us, and we will remove them from within the walls of the city. They'll chase us, ad hatikenu otam min ha'ir. And then, atem takum mi'arev, then you will get up from the ambush and you will take the city and you will destroy it. It'll be empty of all its defenders. It's an ingenious battle plan, and it works. And it's essentially the method by which most kings in Israel, they want to attack a city. We talked about this battle plan. We talked about how they should have attacked Ammon, certainly the second time around. That's how you remove the army from the siege, from behind the walls. But there's a huge issue here, which is that it distorts the focus on Achan. If the issue was Achan, they should have returned to Ai with 3,000 men and been victorious. That would have shown that the issue was Achan. By going back to Ai with the entire army, it seems to reflect a completely different issue. And in fact, that's the issue that Rashi identifies both in Chumash, both in Navi here in Perek Zion, as well as in Chumash. I'll show you the reference. If you go back to Perek Zion for a moment, to Pasuk Zion, to Pasuk Yud. Vayomer Hashem al Yeshua, God says to Yeshua, Kumlach, get up. However, this Kumlach, Rashi says, Kumlach, it's easier to see it. I'm going to show you. Rashi quotes it here, but it's based on a pasuk in Devarim. I'm going to show you the original. I actually showed it to you 2 weeks ago. Devarim Paragimel. Betzavet Yoshua v'chazkeo v'yamtzeu, God says to Moshe, command Yoshua, strengthen him, encourage him. He will go before the people and he will lead them. Says Rashi, quoting the Sifrei, Im ya'avo lifnehem, inchalu. Ve'im lav, lo inchalu. It's a conditional statement. If Yeshua leads them, they will be victorious. If he doesn't lead them, they won't be victorious. And so says the Sifrei, this is the Medrash. Ata motzek ishishalach min ha'am el ha'ai, when Yeshua sent army to Ai, v'hu yashav, and he stayed behind. The result was v'yakum mehem anshei Ai, the people of Ai were defeated. The people of Ai smote them, and Israel was defeated. V'kivan shenafal al panav, when Yeshua fell on his face, Amar lo, God said to him, kum lach, get up, which also could be read as kum lech, get up and go, meaning, you are going to sit here in the tent in the camp and you're going to send my children to war? Why are you on your face? If Yeshua leads them, they'll be victorious. If Yeshua doesn't lead them, they won't be victorious. I told it to Moshe from the word go. You, Yeshua, I'm going to send my children to battle against Ai and remain behind. And so God says to Yeshua in the beginning of Parakhat, the opening statement, Vayomer Hashem al Yeshua, now that you've addressed Achan, we still have to connect the dots. But now Achan's out of the way. You want to go back to Ai? Kach imcha et kol am mechama. You take the people to war. Yukum ale la'ai. You go up to Ai. By Yaakov Yeshua, v'chol ha'am, Yeshua goes with him. And he learns this lesson. It's a very profound lesson. The king, the leader, goes with the army, cannot stay behind. There are exceptions. We talked about this when we dealt with this issue with David. There are moments when the people are afraid for David's life and they ask David to stay behind. But for the most part, the role of the leader is to lead the people. And you see it in the case of Yeshua. I'll show you, interestingly, two cases in Sefer Malachim later in history where this issue comes up again. And where the Navi goes out of its way to highlight the difference between two various modes of military leadership. I'm going to do it here just for the sake of brevity, with having to jump a lot of places, even though the translation is not here. I will translate as we go. But the first, actually, let me just show you here a bit quick reference point. This is a tree of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah later after the kingdom splits. So what we are dealing with is a period of time right around here. So the two kings that I want to show you are, the first is the battle of against the Plishtim led by Nadav ben Yeravam and Elah ben Baasha. More or less, same battle, same era, same context. And the second I'll show you is Achav. Where is Achav? Achav's over here. As Achav and his son Yehoram, and they're both battling the same campaign against the king of Aram. So two different battles, just to kind of see the names of the kings. Here's Melachim Aleph, Nadav ben Yeravam. This is this guy down here, Nadav ben Yeravam. Nadav ben Yeravam reigned over Israel in the second year of Asa. He was an evil king. He was an idolatrous king. Not our issue for today. There was a rebellion in the ranks led by Baasha ben Achiyah. And Baasha kills Nadav in Gibton. Gibton is a city. Asher Lepishtim is a Philistine city. What was Nadav doing in a Philistine city when Baasha killed him? V'Nadav v'chol Yisrael tsarim al Gibton. Nadav and all of Israel were engaged in a siege of the city of Gibton. Nadav was leading the people of Israel. Why there was a rebellion is because of his idolatry, but that's not our issue. But Nadav and all of Israel were engaged in a siege against the city of Gibton asher laplishtim. A chapter later, Melachim Aleph Perek Tet Zayin, in the 26th year of Asa Melech Yehudah, so it's right from the second year of Asa to the 26th year of Asa, it's 25 years later. And Malach Elah ben Baasha, this is Baasha's son, Elah ben Baasha, Vayikshor alav avdo zimni ba'sa machatzit ha'rachev, and there too there's a rebellion in the ranks, and Zimri kills him. But Vahu b'tirtza, war with Gibton is still going on, but this Elah ben Baasha, he's killed when he's caught in his house, shoteh shikor. He's sitting in his house, literally drunk, while his army is sitting in the siege of Gibton, and Zimri, the head of the army, has had enough of a leader who is sitting in his house drunk while the rest of the army is on the battlefield. That is not how the army of Israel operates. I'll give you another example. Achav and his son. Achav is a complicated character. We've had Achav many times, and we'll come back to Achav many times. But Achav dies in a famous battle in Ramot Gilad against Chazael Melech Aram, and there he's leading the people in the battle. He's on the field, he's in the chariot, and V'ish Mashach B'Kesher L'Tumo, there is one of the marksmen, what they call the bow and arrow, the archers, that's what I'm looking for, the archers of the enemy, shot an arrow, B'Yaked Melech Yisrael, and it found its mark, and it hit Achav ben Advakim ben Ashayon, between the shoulder blade and between the blades of armor. It pierced through and it penetrated. So he asks, take me out of the front lines because I've been hit. Now watch this next verse. Nochach Aram v'yamot be'erev. They propped up Achav, wounded in his chariot, in the midst of the battle, opposite Aram, put him on an elevated space where everybody could see, and he was still there and engaged in the battle, so the battle could continue all day till the end of the day. And by nightfall, he had bled to death, and his blood went out, and the rest of the story has to do with Achav. That's an extraordinary death of Achav. It was a warrior who fought the battles of Israel literally until the end of his life, and dies propped up in his chariot, wounded, because he doesn't want to leave the battlefield. He knows if he leaves the battlefield, that'll be the end of the war. Contrast that with Yoram ben Achav, his son, who also goes to war with Hazael, king of Aram in Ramot Gilad. And he's also wounded by Aku Aramim at Yoram. His response to the being wounded on the battlefield, Vayashav Yoram HaMelech liyitrapeh b'Yisrael min hamakim asher yaku aramim. And so he leaves the battlefield and he goes to his palace in Emek Yisrael and to his where his doctors and his nurses and all of his different people, and they can come to heal him, and he can get visitors. And of course, the most important visitor who comes to see him there is Yehu, who is commanded by God to launch a rebellion against Yoram ben Achav and have him killed. And so Yehu comes to pay a visit to Yoram in Emek Yisrael while the war in Ramot Gilad is still going on, and has him killed. The two stories are very similar. You have this almost a generation later, but you have this sense that, you know, contrasting one king who will fight with his soldiers until the very end, and the other thing, the moment he's wounded, the moment life gets difficult, I'm out of here, the rest of the army can do this on their own. And the message that Hashem gives to Yeshua is, you cannot separate from the army of Israel, you stay with the soldiers until you lead them into battle, acharai, you do not stay behind and let the people go to war. Yeshua is told this lesson point blank. First battle of Ai, he sends 2,000, 3,000 men, because that's what the spies told him. Second battle, he comes and he leads the entire army. It's almost as if... Now, okay, so that's the context. I have to still come back to David. I haven't forgotten. My question is, if that is the case, how did the story of Achan and the Chayim of Yericho get so mixed into this story? If the issue is that Yeshua, you need to lead the people, you can't send the people without their king, why is the story of Achan the backdrop? Why is the address to Achan in the middle of the story? Why is this mixed up with the story of the Cherem of Yericho? And the answer to that question, I think, is at the core of the story. The answer to this question has to do with the atmosphere. Let's come back to a key pasuk. When God identifies the chet of Achan, here, pasuk Yud Aleph, when he wants to say that Achan sinned, the language of this pasuk is really quite extraordinary. Vayomer Hashem al Yeshua, kum lach, lama zeh ata nafel al panecha, chata Yisrael. Israel sinned. The gum of wood briti, they violated my covenant. Lakchum in acherim, and the gum lakchum in acherim, and they took of the acherim. The gum ganvu, and they stole. The gum kichashu, and they denied it, and they hid it. What do you mean, chata Yisrael? Last I checked, the acherim of Yericho was violated by how many people? One. His name is Achan. What is chata Yisrael? All of Israel sinned? And I need lots to identify the tribe of Judah and then the family of family by family was the names of the Zerach and then the Zeved and then eventually Acham ben Kami ben Zavdi ben Zerach. You can imagine, right? If you're trying to find the perpetrator, so you start with a lot that I says the guilty tribe is all of Shevet Yehudah. And the guilty family of the households of Shevet Yehudah are Karmi. And the guilty subset of family of Karmi is Zeved. And the guilty, until you get to Acha. What is that?
What's Chatayim? Could it be that they're giving him a chance to come forward of his own volition?
Maybe. It's possible. But at the same time, God seems to identify a guilt that is associated with the entire people of Israel, Chatay Yisrael. And it starts that way too. Vayima'alu b'nei Yisrael ma'al b'cherem. Israel committed a trespass. Not Achan, Israel. All of Israel. Vayikach Achan. So where's the guilt of all of Israel? I think the answer is you can't separate the chait of Yoshua and the chait of the people from the chait of Achan. They're all interconnected. And it all starts from the fact that we've walked away from Yericho with the sense of arrogance of the ease by which we were victorious over the city of Yericho and the self-confidence, the overblown, the inflated self-confidence that says the spies come back from Ai and say to Yoshua, "Oh, Yoshua, this is a city of 10,000 people. You don't need the army, 2,000-3,000 soldiers. Why do you need to bother everybody for? We can do anything. We are invincible. Look what we did to Yericho." And if we're invincible, says Yoshua, okay, so 2,000 people, 3,000 people can go. Even Yoshua is guilty of it. You underestimate your enemy at your own peril. And you underestimate your enemy when you are guilty of an overinflated ego and self-confidence that is misplaced. And the whole purpose of the Cherem, the whole purpose of the Cherem in Yericho was to recognize that Yericho was not their victory, it was God's victory. And by violating that Cherem, they missed that key message that this isn't God's victory. They're saying this is our victory. Look what we did to Yericho. We're not allowed to take the spoils of war after everything we put into Yericho, after all we did in Yericho. Yericho was our victory. And they took of the Cherem. And you think Achan was alone? I'm sure everybody around Achan said, "Ooh, that looks really pretty. Where did you get that?" So, "Oh, I got that from Yericho because I don't believe in this Cherem." So, "Oh, I don't believe in this Cherem too, but I didn't have the guts to take from it. Look what we did in Yericho. Why couldn't we take them? Come to Ai, oh, not a problem. After Yericho, it's a cakewalk. 2,000, 3,000. And that overinflated confidence runs all the way up to Yoshua. You'll forgive me, the contemporary analogy to this is actually very tragic, because it's exactly the same experience that Israel went through between the years of 1967 and 1973. In the aftermath of the Six-Day War, the mindset was, we are invincible and we can do no wrong. And the result was they were not prepared for the Yom Kippur War, not militarily and not emotionally. And the Yom Kippur War did much more than just open on Yom Kippur, but it really, it burst the bubble. But that was exactly the same issue. They were invincible after Yericho. And you cannot underestimate the intensity of your enemy. You cannot walk into this battle with the sense that it's my battle and my victory. And God says to Yoshua, "Chatai Yisrael, all of Israel." And all of Israel includes Yoshua. Yoshua, kum lach. Why are you on your face? You are as part of this problem. And if you want to fix it, you lead them into battle. And you take them all. Kachimcha et kol am hamilchama. And to his credit, Yoshua learns the lesson. And then we'll go back to Ai with a sense of strategy and trepidation and tefillah and recognizing all that is needed in order to win this campaign. That's the Battle of Ai. And that's the Battle of Ai. We come back now to the story of David. I think the parallel is very striking. because David sends Yoav to the battle against Ammon in Perek Yud because he underestimates the intensity of his enemy. In this first campaign, in this first campaign against Ammon, David sends Yoav because that's a city, it's a small little city. It's the capital of Ammon. It's a walled city. It's one people, it's Ammon. We've been dealing with Plishtim, we can deal with Ammon. Not realizing that Ammon had called in to reinforcements all of the forces of Aram and put Yoav's life in danger and the army of Israel in danger in probably the most precarious moment in the history of David's army ever. That mistake was made because David sent Yoav and a small subset of the army and didn't go himself. Fine. That's exactly the same mistake that Yeshua makes at Ai. But Yeshua learned his lesson. And when Yeshua goes back to Ai, with the entire army, him leading, recognizing that you don't make the same mistake twice. David, after the Battle of Ammon, is forced into a major campaign with all of Aram, Bayar Aram. All the way to Naram Naraim. And David hears and he has to gather all of his forces together and he comes to Chelam up there in the north in the Golan Heights, Seir. Up here in this battle here, Chelam. Here's Chelam in the Golan Heights. All of the forces of Aram, all the forces of David and his army. A massive world war. And a war that takes months and a war that is exhausting. But finally, Vayanos Aram flees. And David then goes to Edom. He sends Yoav to Edom. He has to go to Moab. And then by the time it's all done, a year later, he's got to go back and do cleanup and fix the problem at Ammon. And all the time of kings that go out, it's a time of war. David sent Yoav. He sent the entire army. Didn't make that mistake. But David stays behind. And unlike Yoshua, who recognizes that the problem starts with the fact that he did not lead this campaign, David makes the mistake for a second time. This is the second war against Ammon and the second time that David sends Yoav and he remains behind. So it all started. And that is the beginning of his downfall. When David stays behind the second time and doesn't learn the lesson, that's where things begin to unravel. And it's almost the identical issue. If you underestimate your enemy, if you think that Ammon is small and therefore not a big deal. It's just besiege the city, conquer the city, wipe them out, not a problem. If you underestimate the power of your enemy, you are going to think that you are invincible. And David, in the aftermath of, look at the campaigns, in the aftermath of the campaign of Aram and the campaign of Moab and the campaign of Edom, in the aftermath of a conquest of a kingdom that is now spanned literally from Eilat all the way up to the Euphrates River, this is an army that can do anything and has no limitations. So he sends Yoav. He says, okay, Yoav, go deal with Rabbah. Go deal with Ammon. That's a terrible mistake. But David Yosheb Yerushalayim. There's an element of an arrogance. There's an element of a overblown self-confidence that is very dangerous. And in the case of Ai, that self-confidence led to Achan's feeling that he could take the cherem of Yericho, Yerushalayim, that self-confidence, that sense of I can do no wrong, unfortunately leads David to a walk on the top of his kingdom, of his palace, where he sees Bathsheba, from which he has a vantage point where he sees Bathsheba, v'yari shara chetzet me'alagag, and of course, as we say, unfortunately, the rest is history. So more or less, that's part one, where I wanted to recognize or to see the pattern of the two wars with Ammon, both led by Yoav, and in both cases, David is in Yerushalayim. When the first instance, he underestimates Ammon and gets himself into trouble because they invited Aram, David has to be forced into battle in the north, but he comes back from that battle. On the one hand, he's tired and he doesn't want to campaign and he doesn't want to participate in the campaign anymore, that we talked about last week, but more importantly and more dangerously, also comes back from that battle with a certain amount of arrogance. David Yosheb Yerushalayim, and he's walking on the top of his palace. Vayakam David Mi'al Mishkavo, as we saw in the Malbim last week, he talks about all the problems of this parak begin with David Yosheb Yerushalayim. Before we wrap it all up, actually, I'm going to take a pause for a second and ask if there are any questions, because I want to move on to one additional parallel that I haven't yet addressed.
I have a question, and yeah, it's not really exactly relevant to what you're talking about, but why, after they made, was it Acham, give back the stuff, they killed him?
He was guilty of a crime that required...
So he didn't do tshuva?
That's a complicated question. But the short of it is that in the Torah, death by the Beit Din can often be part of the tshuva process.
I got you. Okay, thank you.
All right. I want to go one step further in this story. And this phrase, "Vayitalecha gaga bet ha-melech," we've never really addressed the question of the irony of David, the story beginning by David walking on the rooftop of his palace. We've talked about David Yosheb Yerushalayim. He has no business being in Yerushalayim. If he has no business being in Yerushalayim, he has even less business being on the rooftop of his palace in the middle of the night. Well, it's not the middle of the night, like 8 to Erev, even sunset, evening time. He has no business being on the rooftop. And the Malbim makes this point. The Malbim talks about how he had a big meal and he slept in and he slept late and he gets up and he's... And the Malbim is very harsh in his critique of David in this regard. I don't want to repeat the language of the Malbim, but we looked at it a couple of, I think, last week or the week before. But David is not the only king in Tanakh to be found walking on the roof of his palace at a critical moment. And that leads me to a very dangerous parallel, but nonetheless one that we have to recognize. And that is the other king who is found to be walking on his rooftop at a moment of arrogance, namely... Who am I talking about? Anybody have a clue? King by the name of Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. So I want to take us into the world of Sefer Daniel for a minute. This is Perek Dalet of Sefer Daniel. Now, the reason I'm showing you Perek Dalet and Sefer Daniel in this odd format is because Daniel is written in parts of it are written in Aramaic, and the Aramaic parts of it are very difficult to understand. It's grammatically the same as Hebrew, but it's a different language. It's Aramaic. So this is a text I once put together. I'm using it in my Shabbos afternoon. We're learning Daniel and Shul. So this is a text as the Aramaic original here on the right side, And then the middle column is a translation into Hebrew, and the left column is a translation into English. So it's just easier to work with. Nebuchadnezzar in Perek Dalet, Daniel is his chief advisor, much like Yosef in Mitzrayim and Mordechai in Shishan. And Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and in this dream, he is transformed into a beast of the field, where he is for seven seasons forced to live as an animal and eat grass, etc. So nobody understands what this dream means, and nobody's prepared to tell the great king Nebuchadnezzar. Then he's going to be forced into exile and live as a beast of the field. Till they come to Daniel, and Daniel understands exactly what the message is. And so he says the following. Pasuk Aleph, Ze Pitaron HaMelech. Sorry, I skipped a little bit. Atahu HaMelech Asher Gadalta V'Chazakta G'dulatcha G'dla V'Hegi L'Shamayim B'Shultanecha L'Sof HaAretz. You king, you have grown strong, and your greatness has grown to reach to the ends of the heavens and dominion to the ends of the earth. The fact that you saw in this dream an angel come down and say, cut down the tree and transform it into a beast of the field for 7 years, that means it's a gzera from on high. You are going to be driven from man. You are the king, you are the tree. And you will live like a beast of the field, and you will eat grass, and you will drink from the dew of heavens for 7 seasons. And when will this end? When you learn that it is Most High who rules over the kingdom of men, God is the source of all dominion. Now, says Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar, Atzatiti tavalecha, I'll give you an eitzah, my king. If you want to avert this terrible decree, Chataecha bitzdaka p'dei v'avonatecha b'chon aniyim. You can hold off this punishment through the act of charity and through the kindness to the poor, the mercy to the poor. Meaning, if you show humility and caring and kindness, then you will stave off this decree. And so it was. Leketz yirachim shnemasar, but at the end of 12 months, al hechal malchut shel bavel me'alechaya, the king was walking upon the royal palace, on the roof of the royal palace, and looking out at his kingdom. Ona melech v'yomer, halozoi bavel agdola, this is the great bavel, asher ani v'nitia, which I built, lebet malchut, as a power of my kingdom, v'tokev chosni l'chvod adari, by the might of my power and by the glory of my majesty. This is my bavel. The words were still in the mouth of his king. He hadn't yet got the words out. When kol min hashamayim nafal, a voice from heaven came out and said, L'chaom im Nebuchadnezzar ha-melech, ha-machut avra mimecha, the kingdom was departed from you, and for 7 seasons you are banished, and you will eat like the beast of the fields, etc. And that's exactly what happens the rest of the story of Nebuchadnezzar. There is a moment when the arrogance, where the power and accomplishments of the leader can lead either to a leadership that is filled with compassion and kindness to the vulnerable, or to an arrogance of this is my kingdom which I built. Yoshua stood at that cusp in the aftermath of Jericho and recognized that mistake, backtracked from it after the failure of Ai, and recognized that from that arrogance can come an achan and very dangerous things. Unfortunately, for David, the challenge is much greater. Because if Yeshua's arrogance came out of the single battle of Jericho, David's arrogance spawned from the fact that he was now looking at Yerushalayim after the conquest of the Plishtim, Israel north, Israel south, conquest of Ammon, Aram, Edom, Moab, the entire eastern side of the Arden, all the way up, the battles of Aram, all the way up into the world of Mesopotamia, reaching the Euphrates River. He was sitting at the top of the largest kingdom Israel has ever known. He has alliances with superpowers in the region who have come to him, Parakhet, the end of Parakhet, Veishlach Toi et Yoram beno al Melech David. Toi sent Yoram his son to the king of Dav, one of the kings of Toi Melech Hamat, king of Hamat, what is today Turkey. It's actually a very relevant conversation about making peace with Turkey. Lish'olo l'shalom. And because Israel was so strong, this king of Turkey came to offer a hand of peace, Ulevarcho. Why? Because al-sher necham b'Hadadezer, because we smote Hadadezer, king of Damascus. So because we took out Syria, the king of Turkey came begging at our feet to make peace with him. It's a very contemporary story. This is David sitting on the largest empire the kingdom of Israel has ever seen. And from that vantage point, Yoav is fighting another war, and David Yoshev Yushalayim, Vayitalech Agad Medamelech. And he's walking on the rooftop of the palace. And I can only imagine his vantage point from that rooftop, and he's looking out, and he sees Israel, and he sees the Arden, and he sees the east side of the Arden, and he sees his kingdom, and he sees the empire. And like Nebuchadnezzar, Kaviyachol, Havdil, from that rooftop, he falls. One story, Bathsheba. He falls another story, Uriah Hiti. He falls another story, Ammon. And he falls another story with Avshalom and with Adoniyahu, and with Amnon and Tamar, and then Avshalom. And from the vantage point of that rooftop, David will fall till he hits rock bottom. Like Nebuchadnezzar, who fell from that tower. The only difference is that David has a character to him that Nebuchadnezzar doesn't have. We're talking about Nebuchadnezzar, an evil king, and David is David Melech Yisrael. But what David has is the ability to see himself from the vantage point from the outside when the Navi comes to him in Perek Yudbet and holds a mirror to David's face and says to him, Ata ha'ish, you are that man. You don't recognize who you are. David is able to say Chatati LaHashem and stop the spiral and stop the fall and turn himself around. The power of David is in that ability to put the brakes on in reverse course. That's the transformation, that's the transition that will take us from Perek Yud Aleph to Perek Yud Bet and then eventually through the rest of the Sefer as things progress. But I really wanted us to see the parallel to Yeshua and even the parallel to Nebuchadnezzar, because I think the fact that David is in Yerushalayim is driven by his own mistakes as much as it's driven by his desire to kind of explicate himself from the campaigns that he no longer believes in. But you can't do that. And at the end of the day, the leader, when he separates himself from the people, that's in itself an act of arrogance that caused by the circumstances of David's life, But now those brakes have to be put. And unfortunately for David, too little too late, in the sense that he's already passed the story of Bathsheba before he's able to realize the mistakes that he has made. So we are, that's what I wanted to share with you this evening. Bezrat Hashem, next week, we're still not ready for Perek Yud Bet. There's still one more piece of the story we need to get to, which is the end of the Perek, and deal with a little bit of the marriage to Bathsheba and the timing of Natan's critique of him, the unborn child, a couple of other variables. But I think we've kind of exhausted the first half of the story to the extent that we can. And so next week, Bezrat Hashem, we move forward. 5 minutes left to our time this evening. I will stop for questions. All right. I hope I haven't done David too terrible a disservice, but hopefully we will recoup and rehabilitate our David Melech Yisrael at some point. But for now, we will leave it at this. Have a wonderful evening, everybody. Thank you. Yeah.
Rabbi, when did he write all the Tehillim? Like at what point of his life? Like some of
all through. All through.
It's like so some we will see. A little hypocritical. It sounds bad to say that, but it's a little weird reading through them and thinking that he was doing this while.
So you know, we have this perception of Tehillim as this kind of a feel good. Kind of a spiritual world. First of all, Tehillim is multiple books and texts from different sources. So we have to understand that David is not responsible for all of Tehillim. David writes certain Tehillim that have his name associated with them. There are other authors of Tehillim as well. We have Asaf and B'nai Korach and Yedutun. And there are many
that I have problems with. others.
And so David is one of them. David is also author of Tehillim at very different moments in his life. There are Tehillim that he's writing when he's fleeing from Shaul. There are Tehillim that he writes after the victory against Shaul. There are Tehillim that he writes. There are historical Tehillim, where we know the history of what he's writing when. And there are Tehillim that we just don't know when he wrote. But one of the most dramatic that we will explore in the context of this course is a parak that he wrote, Kishabai Lav Natan Acharei Bathsheba. In other words, he wrote a parak of Tehillim specifically after Natan comes to him and helps him recognize the mistakes he made in the story of Bathsheba.
Do you know what number that is for us?
Why do I think it's number?
I'm sorry if I'm holding anyone else up, but
offhand, no.
Okay, that's fine.
I can look it up and send it out.
Okay, thanks.
But it's a but it's an entire parak devoted to his tshuva after Bathsheba, after Natan's visit. And so we'll look at it because it's important to see it in the context of the story.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi.
No problem. Be well, everybody.
Have a good week.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much.